Hi, good afternoon. Our first speaker today will be Dr. Zeynep Tufekci. Her presentation is entitled The New Media Ecology and Dynamics of Power, Lessons from Egypt and Beyond. Dr. Tufekci is a fellow at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. And before that, she was a fellow at Bergman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Her research interests revolve around issues of impact of technology and gender inequality, new media. And also, you can find her latest reflections in her blog, technosociology.org. Dr. Tufekci.
So thank you for the kind introduction, and I am going to try to talk about some of the mechanisms that social media impacts and that I think have had an impact in the revolutions, the uprisings that we are seeing continuing, collectively named Arab Spring. So I'm going to start with the wrong questions. Was it Facebook or the people has been this question that occasionally comes up. Should we call it, you know, this or that? Should we say the word Facebook revolution or should we not? I mean, sociologically, generally speaking, the question isn't terribly meaningful or interesting. You might have certain ethical reasons to use a particular title versus another one, but in terms of analysis, that's not a very interesting approach, because there's really nothing worth analyzing in the world that is a monocausal event, right? There's always multiple causes that go into any event. And if you're talking about something like political revolutions, political uprisings, it is, of course, the people who've taken most of the risks and who have the agency. But in any particular moment, the different tools and different communications environment may have played a different role. I'm just realizing that. If I turn this on, I think I can walk around away from the mic. Yes, technology and its affordances. Basically, the argument I'm making will be similar to saying that when you have a wireless mic, you can move around easier versus you don't have one. So it does make a difference. I'm still the one talking, but which technology I'm using does change some of the dynamics that is what I can and cannot do. And if for the Arab uprisings in 2011 and ongoing, I think it's a similar thing. So was it Facebook or people? Was it this or that? The answer is usually yes. And if you, as a scholar, what I do study is the social media side of it. That is not because that is the only side of it worth studying or that's the only thing that happened. It's just what I happen to study. And was it online or offline? This is another topic that sometimes comes up that I think is very unproductive and theoretically and conceptually not very useful, because obviously it's the integration of online and offline new technologies and the way they work together is the question. So, of course, right questions for me are things like, how is the public sphere transformed? When you have these technologies, what are the impacts on the public sphere? And communication technologies always do have an impact on the public sphere. The very definition of public is integrated with what technology you are using to constitute that public. So the printing press and the sort of the period after the printing press has constitutions of constitution of different kinds of publics compared with the internet and other technologies after that. So how is the infrastructure of connectivity altered is another question that I think is the right question. So you have humans connecting to each other. We do not live in villages. We do not live in hunter-gatherer tribes for the most part. You know, that's so how people are connected to each other, the mediation of communication always has a major impact on the connectivity. And the other thing is the augmented world, when bits and bytes and atoms collide, and I am going to talk a bit about that. By the way, I just realized there is no clock. Is there I am just going to grab my clock slow because it's a long talk and I don't want to be going completely over. I don't really trust myself to time myself to the T in a 40-minute talk, so I'm going to once again use affordances of technology to structure what I can do. And so let me introduce that concept of affordances. Affordances is something, people who theorize technology have developed to explain how technologies make certain things easier. So each technology isn't just this neutral thing, you can do anything with it. It makes certain things slightly easier, it makes other things less easy. And you can look at each technology and say, what are its affordances? So when you have, say, broadcast media and television, its affordances are communicating hierarchically in a one-to-many environment. It is a broadcast medium, as we call it, right? Its affordance is not allowing peer-to-peer connectivity. You could, you know, think really hard and come up with a way in which everybody has a television receiver and a sender and there's some... I mean, you could really construct some sort of science fiction-y world in which television is also not broadcast. But it's not really, as it's constituted, that's not what it's suitable for. So affordances of technologies is something we are going to be discussing. So what does social media change, and what am I going to talk about? I'm going to talk about pluralistic ignorance and collective action. I'm going to talk about logistics. I'm going to talk about network mobilization, and I am going to talk about attention. These are four conceptual areas that I think social media had a major impact in the days of the revolution and leading up to the revolution. These are not the only mechanisms that social media has had an impact on. There are others, and we're seeing some of these play out in the post-revolutionary period. But I want to talk, you know, sort of keeping with the theme, I'm going to talk about some of the ways in which it contributed, these mechanisms contributed to making these revolutions occur. I'm going to be giving maybe some examples from Egypt and Tunisia and Syria and Bahrain and Yemen, but I will focus a lot more on Egypt too, but there will be some other examples as it comes along. And I want to sort of say it's one thing that I found interesting in sort of living through this period is how many sort of different new technologies and different modalities of politics interface with very old ones. And this is a picture from the February 3rd, I believe. We just had its anniversary. The infamous Battle of the Camel in Tahrir Square, when the thugs of the regime, it's still quite unclear who paid them and how did it happen, attacked the protesters on camels and horseback. So you might remember this moment when people were, you know, the Mubarak had not resigned. There was this sort of, the square was held by the protesters. And we started seeing these tweets, and there was an Al Jazeera live feed at the time, too, saying there are people on camels and horsebacks attacking the protesters with sticks and guns. It was a surreal, you know, you're just looking at your screen and thinking, you're kidding me, right? I mean, it just was one of these crazy things. But as I said, there are so many reports coming at it. So I was after the whole thing was over and Mubarak had resigned and months had passed, I was in Doha speaking with one of the revolutionaries who had been in the square at the time. And we were talking about what an insane moment that was, just, you know, to be afar or to be there. And his comment to me was, well, when I saw the camels, he said, I started laughing. And I said, okay, maybe, you know, you guys don't sleep much there, and you're tired, and you kind of lost it, and you're laughing, you know, what's the joke? Yeah, I didn't really, he was like, no, I thought we'd won. I mean, when I saw the, you know, sort of the camels charging, I thought we won. I said, okay, you know, sleep deprivation is an awful thing, and I'm sure you're very tense, and, you know, nobody's holding you it against you if you kind of lost logic and reason at that point. He's like, he said, no, because it was just so crazy that this regime was fighting, not even, you know, he said they were there, and they were They had found an open internet link in one of their friends' houses in the one ISP that hadn't been disabled, and they were uploading and giving live interviews to BBC and CNN. They were doing this all the circumvention and all this 21st century stuff. And he said, at that moment, I realized the regime only had, you know, not even 20th or 17th. You know, they were in the 15th century, 4th century. They were really centuries behind. He said, at that moment, I realized they really didn't understand what was going on at the square. And I said, yeah, I guess you have a point. This really is, you know, not understanding the sort of the dynamics of 21st century uprisings. And it probably won't happen like that again. I mean, when what we see in Syria, what we see in Bahrain, what we see in other places, what we see anywhere else now is that the lessons of Egypt are learned not just by the protesters, but by the regimes themselves. So I'm not going to talk about the, you know, the post-protest period, but I will talk about some of what those lessons were. And I also want to emphasize that there's no new versus old media. There's just it's the wrong way to think about it. This is a photo I took in Tahrir during a protest, and I took these photos, I think, probably a few minutes apart. And this is, right there, is the Al Jazeera camera that's on the 8th floor. That really has a weird story of how it got there during the days of the revolution. Apparently, Al Jazeera was, you know, the correspondent, Ayman, was looking for a place to put the camera, and all the people who lived around there didn't want to risk having the camera. So he's talking to the doorman to let him into the apartments and go up and down and, you know, just knocking on doors and saying, can we put a camera, can we put a camera? And finally he knocks on that door, and then some guy who's disheveled and just sort of looks like he hasn't slept in a while, wearing this big Che t-shirt, opens the door. And Ayman's like, okay, I think this might work. And he says, you know, you want to make history. The guy's like, okay. And then they put the camera up there. And that camera sort of hovered almost protectively over the square for a while during the whole thing. But it didn't just broadcast live from the square. What it also did was what this guy there was doing, which is everybody on not everybody, but according to my analysis of surveys done with protesters at the time, maybe about 50% of the people were actively taking photos or documenting things somehow. So there was an enormous amount of sort of just amateur citizen journalism. A lot of it didn't go anywhere. A lot of it, people just recorded stuff. Have you ever like been to a concert or something these days? Everybody's just recording, and then everybody's recording, everybody else recording. It's just that kind of everybody recording something. This is very much true there. And some of those videos were uploaded to Al Jazeera and broadcast to the world. This happened in Tunisia before Al Jazeera was able to get in to Tunisia or CNN or anybody. We got our first videos from citizen journalists. So this cycle, this person on the ground who, helpfully, has a Freedom Facebook t-shirt, in case, you know, you don't get my point. And the Al Jazeera camera are not, you know, old media versus new media. It's just this one integrated ecology, and that's important to understand. And the other thing that is important for me to understand is that it's not virtual. This is not, like, the wrong conceptualization of all of this is, like, internet is like the Matrix, some other planet somewhere where you just have to plug in to go, no, it's off this world. It is as real. It is as corporeal. It is part of everything that we do. It's just it works by bits and atoms, and it's the confluence of these things that make the difference, not because it is virtual. This is a Agence France-Presse photograph. I did not take this photograph, but I love this. This is people charging during the protest. They had, it was still there when I went there. You know, they just took down some of the lamp poles and got chargers out. Okay, so let's talk about some of the mechanisms. Collective action problems. What are collective action problems? How does social media have an impact on them? Collective action problems are problems where there is a united interest in doing something, but there are individual disincentives against doing this. They are very heavily studied in sociology, in political science, in all sorts of fields. There's game theory, and there's all this ways of looking at it. But it's basically, let me give you the example that I usually give, and one of these days I am going to regret giving this example. So let's say there's some of you here or just bored out of your mind and you're thinking, oh, I thought this was going to be a fun talk and it's 40 minutes and would she please, you know, go away? And you think this is just an awful talk. And let's say you're sitting right up front and you'd actually like to leave or do something, anything, you know, you're just already regretting it and you're looking at the schedule. But you're thinking, I must surely be the only one, right? Everybody else must be all attentive and listening. And well, let's say that it's actually true, that this is a lousy talk and the whole room agrees. Now, you see the big difference in the situation if you guys have a hashtag during which you're discussing this and saying, yeah, let's just get out of here, versus there's no way you can communicate with each other. It's quite unlikely that somebody who's not able to communicate and coordinate with each other and who's sitting up front is going to get up and say, oh, this is stupid, and walk out. Whereas if you're able to coordinate with each other, because it's impolite, and you guys are, you know, socialized into being reasonable students, and, you know, some of your academics, and we're just socialized not to do it. But if people can organize and get each other's feelings and realize I am not the only one who thinks this way, collective action problems change in nature. So the study of collective action problems is how there is actually a unity about something, but it's hard to solve it. It's hard to coordinate because there's individual disincentives. And usually autocratic regimes very often rule by creating a collective action problem for their citizens. They isolate the dissenters. They punish them severely. It is not just because China's rulers are completely irrational that they'll take some, you know, blind lawyer and try to punish him with 20 years in prison, or they'll like put 10 years of punishment on somebody's tweet. They don't really think a single tweet is going to bring them down. That is not the issue. The issue is preventing collective action cascades. And if you want to prevent collective action cascades, you have to start, you have to stop the initial moments. And pluralistic ignorance, that moment in which you actually are the majority, but you're not really sure what percent of your countrymen or classmates or countrywomen are with you, that's pluralistic ignorance. It's not just autocracy. You can think of global warming. Global warming is a collective action problem. You can think of anything that's public goods where there's individual disincentives. Each country has an incentive to act in a certain way, but there's a different global good. You can see that. So, basically, the public is a meta concept. It's not about just what you know. It's about what you know others know, and what others know you know, and all of that. And here comes the role of Facebook. And this is the We Are All Halit site, a website that you guys might have heard about. This was in the this was a website that had been formed to memorialize and talk about the death of a young man in Alexandria who had been basically killed, tortured under very horrific circumstances by the police who were, you know, just getting away with it. And a lot of young people in Egypt, he became like a symbol of police impunity. And so there's this website. And after the Tunisian Revolution, happened, which was a very important causal factor in all of this, right? It's a very strong, as Mark Lynch is going to speak last, his book makes this very clear, the Arab Uprising, says the name of the book, is that, you know, once you see something happening someplace else, there's a strong demonstration effect. This website turned to a call for the revolution. It said January 25th. Revolution. January 25th in Egypt is police day. Previously, there had been protests on January 25th, but there'd be 150 people and 3,000 cops, so not the best numbers out there. So after Tunisian Revolution, this page called for January 25th, the revolution, and people started RSVPing because an e-vite went out to all the people who were on this Facebook page, at which point hundreds of thousands of people. And this must really be the first revolution in history where you can say, yes, I shall attend the revolution. You know, click an e-vite and say, I am going to attend the revolution. Now, the interesting thing about doing this on Facebook is that that means all your social network on Facebook also sees this. And Egyptians tend to be very Facebook people. When you go there, You come back and you find that everybody you met is trying to Facebook friend you, and next, their cousins are trying to Facebook friend you, and then their cousins' workmates are Facebook friending. It's a very common, I don't really see it, it's an internal Facebook thing. At some point, I'm pretty certain that their Facebook network will be what math people would call one giant cluster. It's like it's the one connected cluster of one component of everybody network each other because they have large families and they Facebook friend each other, which means when you click, I am going to be there on the revolution, you are making a pronunciation to all your social networks. Now, if you consider the fact that a year ago it was 150 people completely outnumbered by the police, the fact that you're seeing all your social networks say they're going to be there has this important effect of breaking down pluralistic ignorance. It doesn't mean you can count on everybody being there. Right? You can't count. There's still all these calculations you must make. How many of them mean it? How many of them are just blustering? Will you go there and be like 175 people instead? But on the other hand, it must be strengthening you and comforting you in many ways to say how many people in your social network. It's not just, you know, it's not like an anonymous billboard anymore. So I compare this with the Tunisian unrest in Gafsa in 2009, where there was a similar unrest to the one that set off the Sidi Bouzid and then the Tunisian revolution afterwards. Long story, mining town, corrupt hiring practices, there's unrest led by the trade union, and the government just censored it. They sent in the police, they sent in then the army, they closed down the place, they shut it down, and you couldn't really get the word out effectively. And at that time, there were maybe 28,000 Facebook users in Tunisia, and not really effective ways of getting news out. And just 2 years later, that was 2 million Facebook users. It was very hard to censor. So that is part of it, the pluralistic ignorance part. So the logistics revolution. I have like a couple of examples that I like to give. One of them is a little Twitter and website that I followed and watched coordinate a particular part of the uprisings was that there were field hospitals around Tahrir. Because you have these big battles with the police or whoever, the thugs, and people are getting injured. And these field hospitals are not really minor things. They can, I mean, they're not actual hospitals, obviously, but there are some battles that took place in Egypt that killed many people, wounded lots of people. There's a lot of tear gas, so there's a lot of jokes about the field hospitals because one of them was apparently in front of the Kentucky Fried Chicken. So it's called the KFC hospital, or KFC. And the Egyptian intelligence at some point was arguing that the revolutionaries were being given free KFC meals from U.S. to create all this unrest, because they're not really patriotic Egyptians. They're just, you know, they're just in it for a KFC meal. I'm thinking, yeah, you know, rubber bullets, real bullets, tear gas, KFC chicken. No, I don't think so. I don't think that's really what's motivating them. But the field hospitals were fairly established and will serve large numbers of people. But of course, you have a problem, because if you have multiple field hospitals in different places, coordinating the supplies, and you'd go on Twitter and you start seeing things like, we need betadine in KFC, you know, field hospital, and then the tweet would be 7 days old. You know, who knows? Did somebody get betadine or not? I mean, it would just be this really hard to understand what was going on. And then a little Twitter feed popped up saying, okay, we're going to coordinate this. This one popped up in the November 2011 clashes, which were pretty horrific and ended up with about 33 people dead and thousands injured. So I'm talking about a large protest and lots of dead people. So you can, it's not a small thing. There were about 10 field hospitals. So the Twitter feed popped up and said, we're going to coordinate this. And so I'm just watching this from the corner of my eye. And they're trying to get attention of people who have lots of followers on Twitter. And, okay, so the long of the story is that over the next few days, I watched this feed coordinate the supplies with a, you know, Google Excel spreadsheet and a website and the Twitter account. And also they were, you know, calling. There's other little sort of impromptu organizations, the Tahrir Doctors and all of that, they were basically coordinating all the supplies. And you could see, you know, this field hospital has this much, this, all the complete list. They were doing the whole thing. And I found is very interesting because logistics, if you have studied at all anything about military history, logistics is what, you know, it's the reason people in Moscow speak Russian rather than French. Napoleon didn't manage the logistics. Or German, Hitler didn't manage the logistics, right? You have, you know, a couple attempts to invade Moscow that failed because you couldn't do what these people are doing with a Twitter feed and some Google Excel spreadsheets and some cell phones. You know, the coordination problem has become quite, you know, different compared to the past. So after all this died down, I talked to the people who were running this. And I said, so who are you and where'd you get the idea? And how did you manage this? Well, it turns out there were three, and sometimes four people maximum. They were all in their early 20s. It was started by a pharmaceutical student in Abu Dhabi, who's Egyptian but lived there, and another one in London, and one person in Cairo. And they're all like 20, 21. And I thought, what the heck? I mean, how the heck does it happen that we live in a world that somebody who doesn't even is not even in Cairo gets the idea? I said, so how long between you got the idea and you set up the website and Twitter account? He was like, 5 minutes. I said, okay. And I said, where'd you get the idea that you could do this? Where'd you get the idea that you could use, you know, social media and Excel and all these spreadsheets and some volunteers? And he had said there was a cupcake store in Cairo whose Twitter feed he'd watched very, you know, the cupcake store was very effective and sort of promoting flavors and coordinating and this and that. So I said, okay, so you got your inspiration from a cupcake store to do. I was like, you know, I'm not going to say anything to you, but the level of ignorance about how hard logistics is, I would have been scared because I know too much history of, you know, how hard logistics is. But then I realized, you know what, my world in which logistics and coordination is this very difficult problem is not the same world anymore. It doesn't mean that it's a no problem, but the kind of tools available to coordinate complicated phenomenon, complicated organizational issues is very different. And this affects not just war or uprising. This affects pretty much anything that depended on sort of you have militaries exactly because they do coordination. And you now have sort of example we see is Syria, where there's a lot of Skype being used to coordinate and cell phones. You saw this in the Iraq insurgency first. In the Iraq, after the U.S. occupation, there was one of the things U.S. did was open up cell phones, right? Saddam Hussein was not letting his people have lots of cell phones. And after the U.S. occupation, there were a lot of cell phones. And by all accounts that you speak to, you know, people in the military, people who have written about it, the insurgents were using cell phones to coordinate in ways that would have been quite hard for insurgents to do just a few years ago. I mean, the militaries have special radios and this and that and all of that. And this imbalance between militaries and insurgents and coordination, the game is different. I mean, one side still might have artillery and the other side might not. So as with everything else, this doesn't make anything obsolete, but it changed it. So let me give you guys, I want to talk about the mobilizing networks and syncretic ecology. So that was logistics. I'm going to talk about how mobilizing networks, and I'm going to tell you guys two stories. One from Syria, Egypt, Bahrain, and one from Egypt. So this one is a story of a Syrian dissident who went under Alexander Page for a while. And he is he is a business person who lived in Damascus. He speaks English very well, and he was reporting from inside Syria. He was giving interviews to BBC and all those sort of outlets in the early days of the revolution, and the regime figured out who he was, and somebody inside must have liked him or, you know, must have been against the regime. So he got a call saying, get out, just move, they're coming for you. And he grabbed his infant daughter and his wife and ran for Lebanon and probably escaped within an inch of his life. You know, if he was probably an hour later, he would have been tortured dead. So, Rami Jura. Okay. So, fast forward sometime later, this is December 2011, and he is going to Bahrain to give a talk at a conference. It's middle of, he arrives at like 3 a.m. or something, and the customs people, he's still traveling with, he's a Syrian national, so he's traveling with a Syrian passport. The customs people say, you don't have, I don't know, paperwork, something. You don't have stamp number X on your visa, blah, blah, blah. If you've ever traveled, like if you have a passport that is, you know, U.S. and Canadian passports tend to get it easy. If you have like a third world kind of passport, I do, Turkish, and then you try to go places, and it just gets really weird. People are looking, they say, well, this is supposed to be on page 23. Why? I don't know. It says so. And it's this Kafka-esque world. So somebody at the border says, your visa is blah, 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 blah. I don't know. He says, okay, fine, you know, I'm here to give a talk, but if you're going to not let me in, I'll go back. He says, no, 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 you're a Syrian national. This is the rule. International rule is you get deported to your country of origin. So we're going to put you, and we're going to deport you to Syria. Now, this man escaped within an inch of his life. So being deported to Syria, not a good idea, right? And he's in the customs area, and he's passed, so he can't really get back out. He can't come in. It's middle of the night, and there's this bureaucrat who says, we are going to put you on the next plane back and you're going back to Syria. He's trying to explain, do you like watch the news? Can we like wait? Can we talk? It's just not getting anywhere. So he starts tweeting frantically. He has his phone. He's tweeting frantically. And it just isn't working, right? So we got a bunch of these crazy tweets saying, they are about to deport me back to Syria. It's really no joke. So at this point, I watched a network of people just sort of try to figure out around the world. It's 3 a.m. in Doha, and everyone's like, so what can we do? This is just as he's desperate. He's not told why. He's not allowed entry. You're going back to Syria. That's it. So we have a 20th century problem. There's a 21st century network on Twitter of people who know him, who are trying to figure out what to do. Their people are alerting newspapers, people are trying to do something, but in the end, he's physically present in the airport in Doha, right? I mean, in the end, he's there. He's going to be physically put on the plane. So you can get reporters, but what are you going to do? It's middle of the night. So it required a 17th century solution, a sheik. So what happened was, what do you mean a sheik? What happened basically was, this is like, I'm from Turkey, so I can pull out, I can be as Orientalist as I want, because I'm part of it. So I think a sheik, you know what, is this a sheik? Sheik with a falcon? This is just, you Google image, and this is what comes up. But what happened is, well, let me not give out, well, he's fine, he's alive, the story doesn't have a horrible ending. What happened was, somebody on the network managed to find a very influential person in Doha. Well, there was like, he managed to find somebody who knew somebody. And the network basically woke up a sheik at, I think, 5 a.m. or something like that. So there was this last mile in which you had to find a person to go wake up. Maybe something really rude. I mean, you're just going to wake somebody up and say, I know it's 5 a.m., I got to wake you up. And sent him to the airport. And if you know the way, you know, these Gulf countries work, a sheik, he just walked into back of the border area and said, okay, this is coming in. So then he was apologized to, and, you know, Rami, everybody said, sorry, sorry, sorry. He's like, oh, thanks, you know, for almost getting me tortured and killed, no problem. And he said, I'm fine, right? So this is this is the interesting thing about this network. It's a 21st century network activated. But it needed a last mile. This is an example of how these ecologies are all mixed, and your last mile was a sheik. So another example that I went through was Mona Al-Tahawi, who's an Egyptian-American writer. And she's very sort of public. She's a public speaker. She writes very sort of highly visible articles, let's say. And she was in Egypt. This is November 23rd, 2011. And there's some clashes, it's middle of the night, and then something happens, and we don't hear from her, and then we see this. And it's middle of the night there, but it's in the evening. So I'm like, whoa, what's happening? And then I talked to a couple of friends of mine who are not there, and Andy Carvin, who sort of curates some of these things. And I said, can we like discuss what to do here? And we started a hashtag that was Free Mona, just to figure out what to do, because, you know, remember, this is what we got. This is all we know. We have no idea. It says Interior Ministry, we don't know. And I was afraid, because she's so public, if they figure out who she is, she could face all sorts of dangers. And, you know, it's just, and she's in the night somewhere. So we did this hashtag, Free Mona, and it was really crazy. Within 20 minutes, it was trending worldwide. It's like, poof, because there's so much interest, because she has a high public presence. So it was trending worldwide. And there was this weird network that sort of sprang to action over this. And one part of the network was people on the ground in Egypt who are with the no military trials. They have lawyers. They have this. They started figuring out the places she might be. Some people contacted the U.S. Embassy because she's also a U.S. citizen. It was really weird watching this because so somebody's on the phone with the U.S. Embassy and saying, okay, I'm on the phone with the U.S. Embassy. I got their emergency number. Does anybody know Mona's birthday? You know, so somebody on the network says, I know her birthday. You know, we're trying to, like, all get... What it's prevented was, like, 30,000 people calling the U.S. Embassy in Cairo because she has, you know, a lot of Twitter followers. We were able to coordinate and say, okay, somebody figure this out. And then Andy and I, we reached out to people we know in the State Department, and Anne-Marie Slaughter is someone who's very active in these sort of circles, and she used to be a director of policy planning when Hillary Clinton was at the State Department. She later resigned, but she was there. So I said, this is a problem. It's not like it's... It would be really better if it didn't wait till the next day or next day, because if they, you know, she's very personality-wise and political presence-wise, it's probably not a very good situation. So she reached out to people. This is, again, middle of the night in Cairo. So she reached out to people, and the rest of it, we, you know, we kind of are piecing together. But what we've heard is that people from, you know, this side of the pond reached out to their Egyptian counterparts, and there was she was released, and she had, you know, her arms were broken, and she had been sexually assaulted. And to give you a sense of how bad things are, I felt like, okay, you know, this is not as bad as it could have been, and that, and the fact that this was not the worst outcome I could think of, so she was released. So these are, you see, the problem that I'm trying to explain how the networks work. It's really fascinating, but it's not just new media, but it is also new media, right? It is you, and in the end, there's this last mile to the State Department and their efforts, but before that, there is the thing. So my final story, and I think I have like 5 minutes, right? My final story is about, it exemplifies how to take attention as a conceptually different category, because attention is one of the things that social media alters, the attention ecology. So it used to mean that to get public attention, you needed mass media. If you don't have mass media, you didn't really get public attention. And there's a lot of literature on how this impacted social movements. The famous book is Todd Gitlin's Making and Unmaking of the Left. It's a story of how the anti-war movement in 60s and on was basically its relationship with media created all sorts of problems for the movement, because that's how you got attention, but some people became movement spokespeople, even though they were getting attention by being the most confrontational, and that didn't really help the movement. Long story. It's no longer true. Mass media remains a very important part of the attention ecology, but it is more complex. So I am arguing that one of the conceptual distinctions that we need to take into account is how is the way we pay attention to things globally, personally, politically, change with social media? So a category I've come up with is the sort of, it used to be that you'd, you know, get, hope Angelina Jolie would pay attention to your calls because wherever she goes, there's 50 million cameras. Or barring that, you know, maybe Nick Kristoff could pay attention to your calls and you'd get a lot of, you know, he has a New York Times column. If you talk to any of the people in the movements that are impacted by these people, like within the sort of global women's rights movement, Nick Kristoff, the debate comes up every other month, I think, is his, whether his role is good or bad, because, well, he has his own agenda, and he gets a lot of attention. But a lot of people in the movement sometimes feel like, you know, he's not highlighting the right thing, or he has the wrong approach, but there's nothing they can do because he is his own person and he gets more attention than the whole movement combined. Same thing with celebrities. There's a lot of literature, you know, scholarship on this. They do take up causes, but they take it up on their own terms. So they're not movement people necessarily. And then you have the movement people, and they may or may not have the same level of attention power. So I'll give you an example that I think of how attention works in complicated ways. It's from Bahrain. She's on Twitter as Angry Arabia. It's Zainab Al-Khawaja. And if you're not following, Bahrain is one of the saddest, and I know Syria is very bloody, so Syria is pretty awful. But Bahrain's not great either, and it has this unfortunate situation of being both close to Saudi Arabia and housing the U.S. Fifth Fleet. So it's got, you know, two strikes against it. The U.S. isn't really going to help democracy, or isn't at the moment willing to sort of negotiate that. And Saudi Arabia has a strong interest in it. Plus, the country's movement is polarized. It's increasingly divided along ethnic lines. Long, complicated story, but it's an ongoing thing. But so she comes from a very prominent dissident family, the Al-Khawajas. There's talk of nominating them for the Nobel Peace Prize this year. It's really an amazing family. Like, there's another daughter who's now in exile. The father is in, he is probably one of the leading dissidents and is now in jail for life. And so she is one of the members of the family. What happened was she started tweeting a lot of things as they were happening. One of the big incidents was when her father was arrested in the middle of the night. She was just sort of tweeting about it right after it happened. This was very emotional, heartbroken, defiant. I mean, it's kind of hard to, you have to go sort of look up some of these things. It's hard to explain the urgency. And she also goes to a lot of protests and just reports from them, so to speak. So, like, you see pictures like this in media all the time. You see pictures like this where she's being arrested, she's being, you know, talked about. And I want to talk about this picture, the story of this picture. This is her. Then the story is, this picture got published a lot of places, including the New York Times. And what happened was she had decided that she was going to conduct more civil disobedience kind of action. So there's a row of police who are on their way to villages where demonstrations are being held. And she steps in front of the riot cars, and you can see she's usually doing this victory sign. So that's what she's doing in the photo, right? She's a powerful photo. She's wearing the abaya. She's got, you know, she's got sort of a scarf around her. There's also video of this event, and so this is not the only angle. This is the best photo. So she stands in front of them and stops the convoy. So this somebody sends this picture out in real time because there's somebody right behind her. So I was online when this happened, so I'm watching this happen. I'm like, wow, that's a very, this is like Tiananmen kind of photo, right? It's a very powerful photo. It's also, it's the Gulf region, and you have all these stereotypes about women and this and that. I mean, it's just powerful in many, many ways. I thought, okay, this is the front page of New York Times probably tomorrow. This is just a very, it'd be hard to be a photo editor and not notice this picture. So as this is happening in Bahrain, the police cannot arrest a woman if they're men, right? Men wouldn't be able to arrest women. So, and apparently the convoy only had male police, so they summoned some female police to come and arrest her. So she's still there, and they're waiting for female police to come. You can imagine there's a huge commotion on social media at this is happening, and lots of journalists are like, what the heck is going on? And I'm seeing all of some sort of people tweeting about it, and people talking to her sisters online. Everybody's kind of talking about what's happening. She's waiting there physically and waiting to be arrested. At the same time, I noticed Sultan Al-Qasemi, who's also a columnist and a writer, sends it out saying, here's the photo. And then I noticed that Sakir Al-Khalifa, who is at the time, let's see, he was the media attaché of Bahrain in Washington, D.C. at the time, he no longer is, responds saying, look, she's breaking the law, she's in the middle of this, you see what he's saying, right? So he responds. But that is basically, you can see that the Bahraini sort of media people in the U.S. have noticed there's this big commotion. And so back in Bahrain, this is what's still going on, and female police come, and they're, like, ready to arrest her. And in her interview later, she says, they're like, no, 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 okay, wait. And they're called back, and they're like, not this one. And it's kind of struck to me, like, they're not going to arrest her, because they arrest her after this photo, right? It's just not, it's very bad publicity for your regime. So you see how this is happening in real time. This is not just citizen journalism having impact by just having very striking photos. But since this is happening in real time, it has these interesting ways in which it's happened. The news director of YouTube, Olivia Ma, once said to me that within an hour of something happening anywhere in the world, they have video of it. YouTube is probably the biggest news site in the planet today. Why? Now, it's of course complicated. Does anybody notice that video? Is it a good thing for that video to be there? There are a lot of incidences in which a video comes out and it's inflammatory. It makes things worse. There are examples of YouTube videos leading to ethnic tensions. There's one in 2007 where, again, long story, a Yazidi girl was stoned to death, and it was videoed and placed on YouTube, and then it caused this backlash, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time used it as a pretext and killed about 1,000 people. I'm just trying to explain awful things can happen from being videos uploaded to, but in this case you can see this. So, not this one, and this is her giving that interview to New York Times. And this is my conclusion here, this. It's the ecology, not any one platform. It's not online or offline, but it's this integration. It changes to pluralistic ignorance, logistics, attention, and mobilization. So it's complex. I gave some examples that sound more sort of positive because we're looking at the revolution and uprisings. But, you know, you could just sort of switch me to the other side and I could give examples in which these same mechanisms led to things you would normatively say as negative and unfortunate. So it's not just, you know, all great and roses, but it's consequential, right? It's consequential in these multiple ways. And that is basically it. I think we have a question.
Yeah, so we have about 15 minutes for questions.
Ten minutes.
For questions after each panelist. Thank you very much for a wonderful talk. If you have a question, please do turn your microphone on and then turn it off after you've asked your question. And if you could also say who you are just very briefly before.
Yes. Okay. I'm Gabrielle Colvin. I'm from the Department of Art, History, and Communication Studies. And thank you very much for that. I guess the question, you know, can either be answered in terms of these revolutions or even more broadly, because it seems to be that the whole field of public relations has to shift because of the fact that now, you know, in very unexpected ways, people on social media can cause a public relations mess for the regime, for MIT in the wake of Aaron Schwartz's death. Do you have a sense of how either governments or corporations are actually trying to reconstitute public relations in the face of social media outbursts?
That's a fascinating question. By the way, Gabriella Coleman, she's just out with a book on open source women and hackers, and it's just great. So I'm very happy to be here. So somebody coined the term. Have you guys heard the term bash tags? So what happens when a corporation goes on social media and, you know, uses a hashtag and says, here, let's discuss X. And once this happened to McDonald's, McDonald's wanted Mickey D's stories to be the hashtag to discuss how great McDonald's was. Well, people took over the hashtag and started talking about lots of awful things about McDonald's and factory farming and something about pink sludge, I don't even know the details, and the hashtag was just taken over. Increasingly, if you're a corporation that has something that's contested, it's not, you just can't go online and say, let's discuss this, because the people who used to be just passive receivers of your PR can now talk back to you. And if there's a small enough or big enough, whatever, a dedicated group of them that want to make a point on the same platform, they can. So we're seeing a lot of examples of hashtags, Facebook pages. I think, you know, you gave the MIT example. I think of the Komen versus Planned Parenthood, which happened where a foundation in the United States wanted to defund Planned Parenthood, and there was a huge social media backlash. They basically went on television, thought they could just weather it the old way, and it just did not work because it grew out of their hands. So there's a lot of examples of what you're talking about. So the question is, and the next question always is, what will corporations, state, powerful actors do in response? Now, in the Middle East, in the case of Middle East, you are seeing a couple of things. Like in places like Bahrain, there's a lot of sort of counter. People will use the same hashtag to counter the points that the dissidents are making. So it becomes very hard to make sense of the social media. In places like Syria, there's a lot of targeting of malware and other kinds of propaganda. Basically, muddying the water kind of situations are there. There is also, I'm seeing increasingly sort of try to use social media's own tendencies to jump up on it. So when there was a power blackout during the Super Bowl, Oreo cookies had a power blackout related ad within like a few minutes of it. So they went, so they're kind of trying to piggyback on it. And it's still, I would argue, it's still not very sophisticated. There's still the kind of public relations and controlling of the audience and the public and structuring of the public sphere within the interest of the powerful. They're still struggling with it because it's not an easy medium. It doesn't just lend itself to broadcast the way television does. But if history is any guide, we will soon see ways in which there's all sorts of structures that enable those with power to dominate the conversations. It might come in, you know, the platforms might turn to corporations for ads or conversations, or there's, so they sometimes sue for copyright. You mock them, they sue you because you're using their copyright. I mean, they're getting better and better at trying to live in this new world of PR, but I think if you're a company or a government with a dedicated opposition, the game has really changed for you. I mean, you can be Oreo and use it and go viral because, you know, who's got a beef with Oreo cookies usually, but if you're McDonald's or Bahrain, it's quite complicated, and we don't, I've seen muddying the water a lot. I've seen, like, you know, bots and like in Bahrain, you see a lot of just, what the heck is this? But I haven't really seen an effective thing beyond that. So,
questions?
Yes. I'm Marcy McLeod. I had a question because the internet age right now, what's happened actually, I know there's data about the U.S., there's been a polarization rather than a discussion. Is that also happening? So people are from opposite sides aren't actually discussing with each other. They just end up sticking to their camp and reinforcing their camp and getting data that reinforces their camp, and they won't get the information from the other
right.
side. There's very little
overlap. Let me sort of say two things in response to that. We're just talking about, there was a book, Eli Prizer had the filter bubble, and there are some, there's long-standing arguments of how internet creates, it allows you to connect with people like you, right? It allows you to connect people like you and only listen to people like you. So I, for example, argued something like the anti-vaccination campaign that we now see in the United States, which is quite harmful to public health and, you know, fueled by misinformation and fear and whatever, probably couldn't have happened pre-social media because those people couldn't have found each other and stuck to each other and tune out all sorts of other things. So this kind of homophily, like these groups, people who find people like them and stick with them and kind of close themselves to other people and then create even more polarization because you now got people like you arguing with people like them, that kind of polarization is amplified by the internet. It has all sorts of negative consequences any which way you look at it. But it's not the only thing that happens. You also see a lot of bridges, right? So the research I've seen basically argues, and my own experience too, you also have all sorts of ways in which you hear from people you would never would have happened. My interactions now involve people across a much broader range of politics than ever before, but I seek that, right? So what might be happening is both. You might have increased polarization, and the polarization might be having all sorts of negative consequences. But you might also be having increased bridging among other segments. You might be, I have people I talk with from all over the world now and across the political spectrum, and a lot of people I disagree with, partly because I do want to have these conversations with them. And this raises all sorts of questions. I don't know whether one effect or the other will dominate over the long term. Maybe they will both happen. It's a question also of how do we engineer our technologies so that they encourage the bridging, right? So there might be some ways in which, and Ethan Zuckerman of MIT is coming out with a book in May called Rewired. I think it's like the age of how cosmopolitans will win or something, but it's called Rewire. He's looking at this very question in depth in terms of the dynamics of polarization and homophilous clumping versus bridging. And since technology is something we design, the question on the table remains, can we design it so that it fosters one over the other? So.
Thank you. And I'm afraid we have to stop to move on to the next speaker, but thank you very much.
Thank you.